Without them, he would be free to go on auditions on a moment's notice. He'd be free to make connections with the acting community in New York City. Originally, it was only supposed to be for 1 year, but one became two. It would have become three, but Natasha's mom could not and would not wait any longer. She was only six at the time, but Natasha remembers the phone calls to America. She could always tell because her mom had to dial all those extra numbers. The calls were fine at first. Her father sounded like her dad. He sounded happy. After about a year, his voice changed. He had a funny new accent that was more lilt and twang than patois. He sounded less happy. She remembers listening to their conversations. She couldn't hear his side, but she didn't need to.
How much longer you expect us to wait for you?
But Samuel, we not no family no more with you over there and we over here. Talk to your daughter, man.
And then one day, they were leaving Jamaica for good. Natasha said goodbye to her friends and to the rest of her family, fully expecting that she would see them again, maybe at Christmas time. She didn't know then what it meant to be an undocumented immigrant. How it meant that you could never go home again. How your home wouldn't even feel like home anymore. Just another foreign place to read about. On the day they left, she remembers being on the plane and worrying about just how they would fly through the clouds, before realizing that clouds were not like cotton balls at all. She wondered if her dad would recognize her, and if he would still love her. It had been such a long time. But he did recognize her, and he still loved her. At the airport, he held them so close.
"Lord, but me did miss you too, you know," he said,
and he held them even closer. He looked the same. In that moment, he even sounded the same, his patois the same as it always was. He smelled different, though, like American soap, and American clothes, and American food. Natasha didn't mind. She was so happy to see him. She could get used to anything. For the 2 years that Samuel was alone in America, he lived with an old family friend of his mother's. He didn't need a job, and he used his savings to cover what little expenses he had. After everyone moved to America, that had to change. He got a job as a security guard working at one of the buildings on Wall Street. He found them a one-bedroom apartment for rent in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn.
"Me can make this work," he said to Patricia.
He chose the graveyard shift so he would have time to audition during the day. But he was tired during the day, and there were no parts for him, and the accent would just not go away no matter how he tried. It didn't help that Patricia and Natasha spoke to him with full Jamaican accents, even though he tried to teach them the proper American pronunciation. And rejection was not an easy thing. To be an actor, you're supposed to have thick skin, but Samuel's skin was never thick enough. Rejection was like sandpaper. His skin sloughed away under its constant onslaught. After a while, Samuel wasn't sure which would last longer, himself or his dreams.
Resign Local takes Westbound 7 train to Childhood's End. Sure, I can be a little dramatic, but that's what it feels like. This train is a magic fucking train speeding me from childhood, joy, spontaneity, fun, to adulthood, misery, predictability. Absolutely no fun will be had by anyone. When I get off, I will have a plan and tastefully groomed, meaning short, hair. I'll no longer read or write poetry, only biographies of very important people. I'll have a point of view on serious subjects such as immigration, the role of the Catholic Church in an increasingly secular society, the relative suckage of professional football teams. The train stops and half the people clear out. I head to my favorite spot, the two-seater in the corner next to the conductor's box. I spread myself out and take up both seats. Yes, it's obnoxious, But I have a good reason for this behavior that involves a completely empty train one night at 2 a.m., way post curfew, and a man with a big-ass snake wrapped around his neck who chose to sit next to me despite there being 1,000, give or take, empty seats. I take my notebook out of the inner pocket of my suit jacket. It's about an hour to 34th Street in Manhattan, where my favorite barber is, and this poem won't write itself. 50 minutes and 3 very poorly written lines later, we're only a couple of stops away from mine. Magic fucking train's doors close. We make it about 20 feet into the tunnel and grind to a halt. The lights flicker off, because of course they do. We sit for 5 minutes before the conductor decides communication would be good. I expect to hear him say that the train will be moving shortly, etc., but what he says is this. Ladies and gentlemen, up until yesterday I was just like you. I was on a train going nowhere, just like you. Holy shit. Usually the freaky people are on the train, not driving the train. My fellow passengers sit up straighter. What the hell? Thought balloons float over all our heads. But something happened to me. I had a religious experience. I'm not sure where he's from. Crazy Town, Population 1. He overpronounces the beginnings of words and sounds like he's smiling the whole time he's evangelizing. God himself came down from heaven and he saved me. Foreheads are smacked and eyes are rolled in complete disbelief. He will save you too, but you have to accept him into your hearts. Accept him now before you reach your final destination. Now I'm groaning too, because puns are the absolute worst. A guy in a suit yells out that the conductor should just shut the fuck up and drive the train. A mother covers her little girl's ears and tells the guy that there's no need for that kind of language. We might get all Lord of the Flies on the number 7 train. Our conductor slash evangelist goes quiet. And it's another minute of sitting in the dark before we move again. We pull into the Times Square station, but the doors don't open right away. The speakers crackle on. Ladies and gentlemen, this train is now out of service. Do yourself a favor, get out of here. You will find God if you look for him. We all get out of the train, somewhere between relieved and angry. Everyone's got some place to be. Finding God is not on the schedule.
Human beings are not reasonable creatures. Instead of being ruled by logic, we are ruled by emotions. The world would be a happier place if the opposite were true. For example, based on a single phone call, I have begun to hope for a miracle. I don't even believe in God.
The Conductor, An Evangelical History. The conductor's divorce had not been easy on him. One day his wife announced that she'd simply stopped loving him. She could not explain it. She wasn't having an affair. There was no one else she wanted to be with. But the love she once felt had vanished. In the 4 years since his divorce became final, it's fair to say that the conductor has become something of an unbeliever. He remembers their vows spoken in front of God and everyone. If the person who's meant to love you forever can suddenly stop, then what is there to believe in? Unmoored and uncertain, he's drifted from city to city, apartment to apartment, job to job, anchored to the world by almost nothing. He has trouble falling asleep. The only thing that helps is watching late-night TV with the sound muted. The endless cascade of images stills his mind and sends him off to sleep. One night, as he's performing this same ritual, a show he's never seen catches his eye. A man is standing at a lectern in front of a huge audience. Behind him is an enormous screen with the same man's face projected on it. He is weeping. The camera pans to show a rapt audience. Some of them are crying, but the conductor can tell it's not from sadness. That night he does not sleep. He unmutes the sound and stays up all night watching the show. The next day he does some research and finds evangelical Christianity, and it takes him on a journey he did not know he needed. He finds that there are four main parts to becoming an evangelical Christian. First, you must be born again. The conductor loves the notion that you can be made anew, free of sin, and therefore worthy of love and salvation. Second and third, you must believe wholly in the Bible, and that Christ died so we may all be forgiven of our sins. Finally, you must become a kind of activist, sharing and spreading the gospel. Which is why the conductor makes his announcement over the loudspeakers. How can he not share his newfound joy with his fellow man? And it is joy. There's a pure kind of joy in the certainty of belief. The certainty that your life has purpose and meaning. That though your earthly life may be hard, there's a better place in your future. And God has a plan to get you there. That all the things that have happened to him, even the bad, have happened for a reason.
Since I'm letting the universe dictate my life on this final day of childhood, I don't bother waiting for another train to take me to 34th Street. The conductor said to go find God. Maybe he, or she, but who are we kidding? God's definitely a guy. How else to explain war, pestilence, and morning wood? Is right here in Times Square just waiting to be found. As soon as I'm on the street, though, I remember that Times Square is a kind of hell, a fiery pit of flickering neon signs advertising all seven deadly sins. God would never hang out here. I walk down 7th Avenue toward my barber, keeping my eye out for some kind of sign. On 37th, I spot a church. I climb the stairs and try the door, but it's locked. God must be sleeping in. I look left and right. Still no sign. I'm looking for something subtle, along the lines of a long-haired man turning water into wine and holding a placard proclaiming himself to be Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. Suit be damned, I sit down on the steps. Back across the street, people are making their way around a girl who is swaying slightly. She's black with an enormous curly afro and almost as enormous pink headphones. The headphones are the kind that have giant ear pads for blocking out sound, also the rest of the world. Her eyes are closed and she has one hand over her heart. She's completely blissed out. The whole thing lasts about 5 seconds before she opens her eyes. She looks around, hunches her shoulders like she's embarrassed, and hurries away. Whatever she's listening to must be amazing to cause her to lose herself right there in the middle of the sidewalk in New York City. The only thing I've ever felt that way about is writing poetry, and that can never go anywhere. I'd give anything to really want the life my parents want for me. Life would be easier if I were passionate about wanting to be a doctor. Being a doctor seems like one of those things you're supposed to be passionate about. Saving lives and all that. But all I feel is meh. I watch as she walks away. She moves her backpack to one shoulder and I see it. Deus Ex Machina is printed in big white letters on the back of her leather jacket. God from the machine. I hear the conductor's voice in my head and wonder if it's a sign. I'm not usually a stalker, and I'm not following her, exactly. I'm maintaining a non-creepy, half-block distance between us. She goes into a store called Second Coming Records. I shit you not. I know now, it's definitely a sign, and I'm serious about blowing with the wind today. I want to know where it leads.
I duck into the record store, hoping to avoid the stares of anyone who saw me acting unbalanced on the sidewalk. I was having a moment with my music. Chris Cornell singing Hunger Strike gets me every time. He sings the chorus like he's always been hungry. Inside Second Coming, the lights are dim and the air smells like dust and lemon-scented air freshener, like it always does. They've changed the layout a little since the last time I was here. The records used to be arranged by decade, but now it's by musical genre. Each section has its own era-defining poster. Nevermind by Nirvana for grunge, Blue Lines by Massive Attack for trip-hop, Straight Outta Compton by N.W.A. for rap. I could spend all day here. If today were not today, I would spend all day here. But I don't have the time or the money. I'm headed to trip-hop when I notice a couple making out in the pop diva section in the far back corner. They're lip-locked next to a poster of Like a Virgin by Madonna, so I can't make out the faces exactly. But I know the boy's profile intimately. It's my ex-boyfriend, Rob. His make-out partner is Kelly, the girl he cheated on me with. Of all the people to run into today, of all days, why isn't he in school? He knows this is my place. He doesn't even like music. My mom's voice rings in my head. Things happen for a reason, Tasha. I don't believe that sentiment, but still, there has to be a logical explanation for the horribleness of this day. I wish Bev were with me. If she were, I wouldn't have even come into the record store. Too old and boring, she'd say. Instead, we'd probably be in Times Square, watching tourists and trying to guess where they were from based on their clothes. Germans tend to wear shorts, no matter the weather. As if watching Rob and Kelly try to eat each other's faces weren't gross enough, I see her hand snake out, snatch a record, and then slip it between their bodies and into her very bulky, perfect-for-stealing jacket. No way. I'd rather burn my eyes out than keep watching, but I do. I can't actually believe what I'm seeing. They devour each other for another few seconds, and then her hand sneaks out again. Oh my God, they're gross. Why are they so gross? The words slip out of my mouth before I can stop them. Like my mom, I have a tendency to say my thoughts out loud. She's just gonna steal that? Asks an equally incredulous voice beside me. I quickly glance over to see who I'm talking to. It's an Asian boy wearing a gray suit and a ridiculously bright red tie. I turn back to watch some more. Doesn't anybody work here? Can't they see what's happening? I ask, more to myself than to him.
Shouldn't we say something?
To them? I ask, gesturing at the little thieves.
The staff, maybe?
I shake my head without looking at him. I know them, I say.
Sticky Fingers is your friend?
His voice is slightly accusatory. She's my boyfriend's girlfriend. Red Tie turns his attention away from the crime in progress and on to me.
How does that work, exactly?
He asks. I mean, ex-boyfriend, I say. He cheated on me with her, actually. I'm more flustered about seeing Rob than I realize. It's the only explanation for me volunteering that piece of information to a stranger. Red Tie shifts his attention back to the petty larceny.
Great pair, a cheater and a thief.
I half laugh.
We should tell someone, he says.
I shake my head. No way, you do it.
Strength in numbers, he says back.
If I say something, it's going to look like I'm jealous and messing with them.
Are you?
I look at him again. His face is sympathetic. That's kind of a personal question, isn't it, Red Tie? I ask. He shrugs.
We were having a moment, he says.
Nope, I say, and turn away again to watch them. Rob feels me watching and catches my eye before I can look away.
Jesus Christ, bleeding on a popsicle stick, I whisper under my breath.
Rob gives me his patented stupid half-smile and a wave. I almost give him the finger. How did I date him for 8 months and 4 days? How did I let this accomplice hold my hands and kiss me? I face Red Tie. Is he coming over here?
Yup.
Maybe we should make out or something, like spies do in the movies, I suggest. Red Tie blushes hard. I'm not serious, I say, smiling. He doesn't say anything, just blushes some more. I watch the color warm his face. Rob's there before Red Tie can pull himself together to respond.
Hey,
he says. His voice is a deep, reassuring baritone. It's one of the things I liked about him. Also, he looks like a young Bob Marley, only white and without the dreadlocks.
Why are you and your girlfriend stealing things?
Red Tie cuts in before I can say anything to Rob. Rob holds his hands up and takes a step back.
Whoa, dude, he says. Keep your voice down.
He pastes the stupid half-smile back on his stupid face. Red Tie gets even louder.
This is an independent record store. That means it's family-owned. You're stealing from real people. Do you know how hard it is for small businesses to survive when people like you just take stuff?
Red Tie is righteous, and Rob even manages to look a little chastened. Don't look now, but I think your girlfriend just got busted, I say. Two store employees are whispering furiously at Kelly and tapping the front of her jacket. Rob's stupid face finally loses its stupid smile. Instead of going over to rescue Kelly, he shoves his hands into his pockets and runs out the front door. Kelly calls out to him as he bolts, but he doesn't stop. One of the employees threatens to call the cops. She begs him not to and pulls two records from her jacket. She has good taste. I spot Massive Attack and Portishead. The employee snatches them from her hand.
Come back in here again and I will call the cops.
She bolts from the store, calling after Rob.
Well, that was fun, Red Tie says after she's gone.
He's smiling a big wide smile and looking at me with happy eyes. I get a sudden sense of deja vu. I've been here before. I've noticed those bright eyes and that smile. I've even had this conversation. But then the moment passes. He sticks out his hand for a shake.
Daniel,
he says. His hand is big and warm and soft and holds on to mine for a little too long. Nice to meet you, I say, and take my hand back. His smile is nice. Really nice. But I don't have time for boys in suits with nice smiles. I put my headphones back on. He's still waiting for me to tell him my name. Have a nice life, Daniel, I say, and walk out the door.
Would-be Casanova shakes cute girl's hand, offers her home loan with reasonable interest rate. I shook her hand. I'm wearing a suit and a tie, and I shook her hand. What am I, a banker? Who meets a cute girl and shakes her hand? Charlie would have said something charming to her. They'd be having a cozy coffee someplace dark and romantic. She'd already be dreaming of little half-Korean, half-African-American babies.
Outside, the streets are more crowded than before. The crowd is a mix of tourists who've wandered too far from Times Square and actual working New Yorkers wishing the tourists would just go back to Times Square. A little ways down the street, I spy Rob and Kelly. I stand there staring at them for a little while. She's crying, and no doubt he's trying to explain that he is not an unfaithful, disloyal jerk. I have a feeling he will be successful. He's very persuasive, and she wants to be persuaded. He and I sat next to each other in AP Physics last year. The only reason I noticed him at all was because he asked for help on the isotopes and half-lives unit. I'm something of an overachiever in that class. He asked me out to the movies after he passed the following week's quiz. Coupledom was new to me, but I liked it. I liked meeting at his locker between classes and always having plans for the weekend. I liked being thought of as a couple and double dating with Bev and Derek. As much as I hate to admit it now, I liked him. And then he cheated. I can still remember feeling hurt and betrayed, and weirdly ashamed, like it was my fault he cheated. The thing I could never figure out, though, was why he pretended. Why not just break up with me and go out with Kelly instead? Still, getting over him didn't take that long at all. And that's the thing that makes me wary. Where did all those feelings go? People spend their whole lives looking for love. Poems and songs and entire novels are written about it. But how can you trust something that can end as suddenly as it begins?
Half-Life, A History of Decay. The half-life of a substance is the time it takes for it to lose one half of its initial value. In nuclear physics, it's the time it takes for unstable atoms to lose energy by emitting radiation. In biology, it usually refers to the time it takes to eliminate half of a substance, water, alcohol, pharmaceuticals, from the body. In chemistry, it is the time required to convert one half of a reactant, hydrogen or oxygen, for example, to product, water. In love, it's the amount of time it takes for lovers to feel half of what they once did. When Natasha thinks about love, this is what she thinks. Nothing lasts forever. Like hydrogen 7, or lithium 5, or boron 7, love has an infinitesimally small half-life that decays to nothing. And when it's gone, it's like it was never there at all.
Girl Who Has No Name is stopped at a crosswalk ahead of me. I swear I'm not following her. She's just going my way. Her super pink headphones are back on, and she's swaying to her music again. I can't see her face, but I'm guessing her eyes are closed. She misses a walk cycle, and now I'm right behind her. If she turned around, she would definitely think I'm stalking her. The light turns red again, and she steps off the curb. She's not paying enough attention to realize that a guy in a white BMW is about to run that red light, but I'm close enough. I yank her backward by her arm. Our feet tangle. We trip over each other and fall onto the sidewalk. She lands half on top of me. Her phone's not as lucky and crashes against the pavement. A couple of people ask if we're okay, but most just make a beeline around us as if we're just another object in the obstacle course that is New York City. No Name Girl shifts herself off me and looks down at her phone. A few cracks spiderweb across the screen. "What the hell?" she says. Not a question so much as a protest. "You okay? That guy almost killed me." I look up and see that the car has pulled over to the side on the next block. I want to go yell at the driver, but I don't want to leave her alone. "You okay?" I ask again. "Do you know how long I've had this?" At first I think she means her phone, but it's her headphones she's cradling in her hands. Somehow they got damaged during our fall. One of the ear pads is dangling from wires, and the casing is cracked. She looks like she's going to cry. I'll buy you another pair. I'm desperate to prevent her tears, but not because I'm noble or anything. I'm kind of a contagion crier. You know how when one person starts yawning, everyone else starts yawning too? Or when someone vomits, the smell makes you want to hurl? I'm like that, except with crying, and I have no intention of crying in front of the cute girl whose headphones I just broke. A part of her wants to say yes to my offer, but I already know she won't. She presses her lips together and shakes her head. It's the least I can do, I say. Finally, she looks at me. You already saved my life. You wouldn't have died. A little maimed, maybe. I'm trying to get her to laugh, but nothing doing. Her eyes fill with tears. I'm having just the worst day, she says. I look away so she doesn't see my own tears forming.
Donald Christensen, A History of Money. Donald Christensen knows the price of priceless things. He has actuarial tables in his mind. He knows the cost of a human life lost in an airplane crash, a car accident, a mining disaster. He knows these things because he once worked in insurance. It was his job to price the unwanted and unexpected. The price of accidentally running over a 17-year-old girl who was clearly not paying attention is considerably less than the price for his own daughter, killed by a texting driver. In fact, the first thing he'd thought when he heard the news about his daughter was what price the driver's insurance company would pay. He pulls over to the side of the road, turns on his hazards, and lays his head on the steering wheel. He touches the flask in his inside coat pocket. Do people recover from these things? He doesn't think they do. It's been 2 years, but the grieving has not left him, shows no signs of leaving until it's taken everything from him. It has cost him his marriage, his smile, his ability to eat enough, sleep enough, and feel enough. It has cost him his ability to be sober, which is why he almost ran over Natasha just now. Donald is not sure what the universe was trying to tell him by taking away his only daughter. But here is what he learned. No one can put a price on losing everything. And another thing, all your future histories can be destroyed in a single moment.
Red Tie looks away from me. I think he's about to cry, which makes no sense at all. He offers to buy me new headphones. Even if I let him, new ones couldn't replace these. I've had them since right after we moved to America. When my father bought them for me, he was still hopeful for all he would accomplish here. He was still trying to convince my mom that the move away from the country of our birth, away from all our friends and family, would be worth it in the end. He was going to hit it big. He was going to get the American dream that even Americans dream about. He used me and my brother to help convince my mom. He bought us gifts on layaway, things we could barely afford even on layaway. If we were happy here, then maybe the move was right after all. I didn't care what the reason for the gifts was. These way too expensive headphones were my favorite of them all. I only cared that they were my favorite color and promised audiophile quality sound. They were my first love. They know all my secrets. They know how much I used to worship my dad. They know that I kind of hate myself for not worshiping him at all now. It seems like such a long time ago when I thought the world of him. He was some exotic planet, and I was his favorite satellite. But he's no planet, just the final fading light of an already dead star. And I'm not a satellite. I'm space junk, hurtling as far as I can away from him.
I don't think I've ever noticed anyone the way I'm noticing her. Sunlight filters through her hair, making it look like a kind of halo around her head. A thousand emotions pass over her face. Her eyes are black and wide with long lashes. I can imagine staring into them for a long time. Right now they're dull, but I know exactly what they will look like, bright and laughing. I wonder if I can make her laugh. Her skin is a warm and glowing brown. Her lips are pink and full, and I'm probably staring at them for far too long. Fortunately, she's too sad to notice what a shallow and horny jerk I am. She looks up from her broken headphones. As our eyes meet, I get a kind of déjà vu. But instead of feeling like I'm repeating something in the past, it feels like I'm experiencing something that will happen in my future. I see us in old age. I can't see our faces. I don't know where or even when we are. But I have a strange and happy feeling that I can't quite describe. It's like knowing all the words to a song but still finding them beautiful and surprising.
I stand up and dust myself off. This day can't get any worse. It must eventually end. Were you following me? I ask him. I'm crankier and testier than I should be with someone who just saved my life. Man, I knew you would think that. You just happened to be right behind me. I fiddle with my headphones, trying to reattach the ear pad, but it's hopeless. Maybe I was meant to save your life today, he says. I ignore that. Okay, thanks for your help, I say, preparing to leave. At least tell me your name, he blurts out. Red Tie, Daniel. Okay, Daniel. Thank you for saving me. That's a long name. His eyes don't leave mine. He's not going to give up until I tell him. Natasha. I think he's going to shake my hand again, but instead he shoves his hands into his pockets. Nice name. So glad you approve, I say, giving him my most sarcastic tone. He doesn't say anything else, just looks at me with a slight frown, as if he's trying to figure something out. Finally, I can't take it anymore. Why are you staring at me? He blushes again, and now I'm staring. I can see how it might be fun to tease him just to get him to blush. I let my eyes wander the sharp planes of his face. He is classically handsome, debonair even. Watching him stand there in his suit, I can picture him in a black and white Hollywood romantic comedy, trading witty banter with his heroine. His eyes are clear brown and deep set. Somehow I can tell he smiles a lot. His thick black hair is pulled back into a ponytail. Observable fact. The ponytail pushes him from handsome to kind of sexy. Now you're staring, he says to me. It's my turn to blush. I clear my throat. Why are you wearing a suit? I have an interview later. Want to go get something to eat? What for? I ask. Yale. Alumni admission interview. I applied early decision. I shake my head. No, I meant, why do you want to get something to eat? I'm hungry, he says, as if he's not sure exactly. I say. I'm not. Coffee then? Or tea or soda or filtered water? Why? I ask. Realizing that he's not going to give up. His shoulders shrug, but his eyes don't. Why not? Besides,
I'm pretty sure you owe me your life, since I just saved it.
Believe me, I tell him, you don't want my life.
We walk two long blocks west toward 9th Ave and pass no fewer than three coffee shops. Two of them are from the same national coffee chain. Have you ever seen anyone actually dunk a donut? I choose the non-chain, independent one because we mom-and-pop places gotta stick together. The place is all mahogany and dark wood furniture and smells just like you'd think it would. It's also just slightly over the top. And by slightly, I mean there are several oil paintings of single coffee beans hanging on the wall. Who knew coffee bean portraiture was a thing? Who knew they could look so forlorn? There's barely anyone else here, and the three baristas behind the counter look pretty bored. I try to spice up their lives by ordering an overly elaborate drink involving half shots, milks of varying fat content, and caramel, as well as vanilla syrup. They still look bored. Natasha orders black coffee with no sugar. It's hard not to read her personality into her coffee order. I almost say something, but then I realize she might think I'm making a race-related joke, which would be a very poor, on a scale from poor to extremely poor. The full scale is poor, somewhat poor, moderately poor, very poor, and extremely poor way to start off this relationship. She insists on paying, saying it's the least she can do. My drink is $6.38, and I let her know that the cost of saving a life is at least two elaborate coffee drinks. She doesn't even smile. I choose a table and back as far away from the non-action as possible. As soon as we sit, she pulls out her phone to check the time. It's still working, despite the cracks on the screen. She runs her thumb along them and sighs. Have to be somewhere? I ask. Yes, she says, and turns the phone off. I wait for her to continue, but she's definitely not going to. Her face dares me to ask her more, but I've reached my quota of daring things. 1 equals following cute girl. 2 equals yelling at ex-boyfriend of cute girl. 3 equals saving life of cute girl. 4 equals asking out cute girl for the day. We sit in a not at all comfortable silence for 33 seconds. I fall into that super self-conscious state you get into when you're with someone new and you really want them to like you. I see all my movements through her eyes. Does this hand gesture make me seem like a jerk? Are my eyebrows crawling off my face? Is this a sexy half smile or do I look like I'm having a stroke? I'm nervous, so I exaggerate all my movements. I blow on my coffee, sip it, stir it, playing the part of an actual human teenage boy having an actual beverage called coffee. I blow too hard on my drink and a little foam flies up. I cannot be any cooler. I would totally date me. Not really. It's hard to say, but she may have smiled ever so slightly at the foam flight. Still happy you saved my life? She asks. I take too big a sip and burn not only my tongue, but a path all the way down my throat. Jesus Christ. Maybe this is a sign I should just give up. I am clearly not meant to impress this girl. Should I regret it? I ask. Well, I'm not exactly being nice to you. She's pretty direct, so I decide to be direct too. That's true, but I don't have a time machine to go back and undo it. I say it with a straight face. Would you? She asks, frowning slightly. Of course not, I say. What kind of jerk does she think I am? She excuses herself to go to the bathroom. So that I don't just sit there looking uninteresting when she gets back, I pull out my notebook to fiddle with my poem. I'm still writing when she gets back. Oh, no. She groans as she sits back down. What? I ask. She gestures to my notebook. You're not a poet, are you? Her eyes are smiling, but still, I close it quickly and slip it back into my jacket. Maybe this wasn't such a good idea. What am I thinking with my deja vu in reverse nonsense? I'm just putting off the future. Like my parents want, I'll marry a lovely Korean-American girl. Unlike Charles, I don't have anything against Korean girls. He says they're not his type, but I don't really get the concept of having a type. My type is girls. All of them. Why would I limit my dating pool? I'll be a great doctor with excellent bedside skills. I'll be perfectly happy. But something about Natasha makes me think my life could be extraordinary. It's better for her to be mean and for us to go on separate paths. I can think of exactly no ways that my parents, mostly my dad, would be okay with me dating a black girl. Still, I give it one last try. What would you do with the time machine if you had one? For the first time since we sat down, she doesn't seem irritated or bored. She furrows her brow and leans forward. Can it travel into the past? Of course, it's a time machine, I say. She gives me a look that says there's so much I don't know. Time travel to the past is a complicated business. Say we've gotten past the complications, what would you do? She puts down her coffee, folds her arms across her chest. Her eyes are brighter. And we're ignoring the grandfather paradox? She asks. Completely, I say, pretending I have a clue what she's talking about, but she calls me out. You don't know the grandfather paradox? Her voice is incredulous, like I've missed some basic information about the world, like how babies are made. Is she a sci-fi nerd? Nope, don't know it, I say. Okay, let's say you have an evil grandfather. He's dead. I only met him once in Korea. He seemed nice. Are you Korean? She asks. Korean-American. I was born here. I'm Jamaican, she says. I was born there. But you don't have an accent. Well, I've been here for a while. She tightens her hold on her cup, and I can feel her mood starting to shift. Tell me about this paradox, I prod, trying to distract her. It works, and she brightens up again. Okay, yes. Let's say your grandfather was alive, and he was evil. Alive and evil, I say, nodding. He's really evil. So you invent a time machine and go back in time to kill him. Say you kill him before he meets your grandmother. That would mean that one of your parents is never born, and that you are never born, so you can't go back in time to kill him. But if you kill him after he meets your grandmother, then you will be born, and then you'll invent a time machine to go back in time to kill him. This loop will go on forever. Huh. Yes, we're definitely ignoring that. And the Novikov self-consistency principle too, I guess. I thought she was cute before, but she's even cuter now. Her face is animated. Her hair is bouncing, and her eyes are sparking. She's gesturing with her hands, talking about researchers at MIT and probability bending to prevent paradoxes. So theoretically, you wouldn't be able to kill your grandfather at all, because the gun would misfire at just the right moment, or you would have a heart attack, or a cute Jamaican girl would walk into the room and bowl me over. Yes. Something strange and improbable would happen so that the impossible couldn't. Huh, I say again. That's more than a huh, she says, smiling. It is more than a huh, but I can't think of anything clever or witty to say. I'm having trouble thinking and looking at her at the same time. There's a Japanese phrase that I like, koi no yokan. It doesn't mean love at first sight. It's closer to love at second sight. It's the feeling when you meet someone that you're going to fall in love with them. Maybe you don't love them right away, but it's inevitable that you will. I'm pretty sure that's what I'm experiencing right now. The only slight, possibly insurmountable problem is that I'm pretty sure that Natasha is not.
I don't tell Red Tie the complete truth
about what I would do with the time machine if I had one. I would travel back in time and make it so the greatest day of my father's life never happened at all. It is completely selfish, but it's what I would do so my future wouldn't have to be erased. Instead, I explain all the science to him. By the time I'm done, he's giving me a look like he's in love with me. It turns out he's never heard of the grandfather paradox or the Novikov self-consistency principle, which kind of surprises me. I guess I assumed he'd be nerdy because he's Asian, which is crappy of me because I hate when other people assume things about me like I like rap music or I'm good at sports. For the record, only one of those things is true. Besides the fact that I'm being deported today, I am really not a girl to fall in love with. For one thing, I don't like temporary, non-provable things. And romantic love is both temporary and non-provable. The other secret thing that I don't say to anyone is this. I'm not sure I'm capable of love. Even temporarily. When I was with Rob, I never felt the way the songs say you're supposed to feel. I didn't feel swept away or consumed. I didn't need him like I needed air. I really liked him. I liked looking at him. I liked kissing him. But I always knew I could live without him. Red tie, I say. Daniel, he insists. Don't fall in love with me, Daniel. He actually sputters out his coffee.
Who says I'm going to?
That little black notebook I saw you scribbling in and your face. Your big, wide open, couldn't fool anybody about anything face says you're going to. He blushes again, because blushing is his entire state of being.
And why shouldn't I?
He asks. Because I'm not going to fall in love with you.
How do you know?
I don't believe in love.
It's not a religion, he says. It exists, whether you believe in it or not.
Oh, really? Can you prove it?
Love songs, poetry, the institution of marriage.
Please, words on paper. Can you use the scientific method on it? Can you observe it, measure it, experiment with it, and repeat your experiments? You cannot. Can you slice it and stain it and study it under a microscope? You cannot. Can you grow it in a petri dish or map its gene sequence?
You cannot, he says, mimicking my voice and laughing.
I can't help laughing, too. Sometimes I take myself a little seriously. He spoons a layer of foam off his coffee and into his mouth.
You say it's just words on paper, but you have to admit all those people are feeling something.
I nod. Something temporary and not at all measurable. People just want to believe. Otherwise, they would have to admit that life is just a random series of good and bad things that happen until one day you die.
And you're okay with believing that life has no meaning?
What choice do I have? This is what life is. Another spoon of foam and more laughter from him.
So, no fate, no destiny, no meant to be for you.
I am not a nincompoop, I say, definitely enjoying myself more than I should be. He loosens his tie and relaxes back into his chair. A strand of his hair escapes his ponytail, and I watch as he tucks it behind his ear. Instead of pushing him away, my nihilism is only making him more comfortable. He seems almost merry.
I don't think I've ever met anyone so charmingly deluded, he says,
as if I'm a curiosity. And you find that appealing? I ask.
I find it interesting, he says.
I take a look around the cafe.
Somehow, it's filled up without me noticing. People line the bar, waiting for their orders. The speakers are playing Yellow Ledbetter by Pearl Jam, another one of my favorite 90s grunge rock bands. I can't help it. I have to close my eyes to listen to Eddie Vedder mumble sing the chorus. When I open them again, Daniel is staring at me. He shifts forward so his chair is grounded again on all four legs.
What if I told you I could get you to fall in love with me scientifically?
I would scoff, I say. A lot.
Multiverses, a quantum history. One possible solution to the grandfather paradox is the theory of multiverses originally set forth by Hugh Everett. According to multiverse theory, every version of our past and future histories exists just in an alternate universe. For every event at the quantum level, the current universe splits into multiple universes. This means that for every choice you make, an infinite number of universes exist in which you made a different choice. The theory neatly solves the grandfather paradox by positing separate universes in which each possible outcome exists, thereby avoiding a paradox. In this way, we get to live multiple lives. There is, for example, a universe where Samuel Kingsley does not derail his daughter's life. A universe where he does derail it, but Natasha is able to fix it. A universe where he does derail it, and she is not able to fix it. Natasha is not quite sure which universe she's living in now.
Area Boy attempts to use science to get the girl. I wasn't kidding about the falling in love scientifically thing. There was even an article in the New York Times about it. A researcher put two people in a lab and had them ask each other a bunch of intimate questions. Also, they had to stare into each other's eyes for 4 minutes without talking. I'm pretty sure I'm not getting her to do the staring thing with me right now. To be honest, I didn't really believe the article when I read it. You can't just make people fall in love, right? Love is way more complicated than that. It's not just a matter of choosing a couple of people and making them ask each other some questions, and then love blossoms. The moon and the stars are involved. I'm certain of it. Nevertheless, according to the article, the result of the experiment was that the two test subjects did indeed fall in love and get married. I don't know if they stayed married. I kind of don't want to know, because if they did stay married, then love is less mysterious than I think and can be grown in a petri dish. If they didn't stay married, then love is as fleeting as Natasha says it is. I pull out my phone and look up the study. 36 questions. Most of them are pretty stupid, but some of them are okay. I like the staring into the eyes thing. I'm not above science.
He tells me about some study involving a lab and questions and love. I am skeptical and say so. I'm also slightly intrigued, but don't say so.
What are the 5 key ingredients to falling in love? He asks me.
I don't believe in love, remember? I pick up my spoon and stir my coffee, even though there's nothing to stir together.
So what are the love songs really about?
Easy, I say. Lust.
And marriage?
Well, lust fades, and then there are children to raise and bills to pay. At some point, it just becomes friendship with mutual self-interest for the benefit of society and the next generation. The song ends just as I finish talking. For a moment, all we can hear are glasses clinking and milk frothing.
Huh,
he says, considering. You say that a lot, I say.
I could not disagree with you more.
He adjusts his ponytail without letting his hair fall into his face. observable fact. I want to see his hair fall into his face.